Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Times Redbox podcast. If you're thinking, oof, Matt Chorley sounds fresh and dynamic, no, it's still me, Luke Jones, sitting in. Matt will be back next week once he's sobered up from his stay-at-home garden holiday. Today, what with it being LGBT History Month, we're going to hear how the UK Parliament has become the gayest it's ever been. Blue, red and yellow from the rainbow flag will be here. Conservative Justine Greening, Labour's Chris Bryant and the SNP's Hannah Bardell. Plus, we're going to have a great leaf for the parliamentary archives as well. But first, our columnists today, Danny Finkelstein and David Aronovich. First of all, what do you make of all of this seemingly good news that's on the front of the papers? We just had David Spiegelhalter on the programme saying that he thinks that excess deaths will be back to normal levels, quote, by next month, which sounds incredibly good from the statistics which he's seeing coming out this morning. Danny, should we be cheering and unlocking sooner, as many people are calling for?
No. Yes, but no. Obviously, what we do need to obviously reach some sort of balance as to the costs of locking down versus the risks that we'd be taking opening up. And that is obviously a calculation to be made. But I think the government's right to be on the cautious side. It was the policy I think it should have pursued in the autumn as well. Mm. It's very good. I think the vaccine strategy that we've been following is the right strategy. In other words, the one dose strategy, I think, has been bold and it's been correct. And fortunately, both the combination of lockdown, which we've done the same as other countries, and obviously our successful vaccine rollout has made this possible.
David, what do you think? The cautious approach is right? I mean, the Daily Mail is suggesting that even like stay at home could be scrapped soon.
The Daily Mail, as far as I can see, the Daily Mail and the Telegraph and papers like this seem to have a kind of agenda, which is always to push the government to open up earlier than it would. And I think we've already seen what happened with that back in the autumn and before Christmas. It was catastrophic. I mean, the first thing to say is we've had a very successful vaccine rollout after an incredibly large period of deaths and hospitalisations and so on. And we've had a very severe lockdown, and you would expect the levels of hospitalisations and deaths to come down significantly now, and for the transmission rate to come down significantly now. And I don't think anybody in their right minds doubted that that would be the consequences of those things happening. Mm. So the question is always going to be, Firstly, are there new variants out there which would otherwise alter the calculation about when we can open up and how we can open up and so on? And will we be able to deal with those variants? And then the question about how it will affect groups lower than the group that's most likely to die if we were to have an over hasty opening up. And the thing, I mean, the obvious thing to say is, like Danny, like you, I am desperate for things to open up. I cannot, I mean, like other people, I've reached low points within the last few weeks, which I didn't think I could actually reach before. I'm desperate for this to happen, but I don't want to go back to it either if we've opened up prematurely. That's the judgment that the government seem to be making. As far as I can see, as long as they ignore the Mail, the Telegraph and silly people in the Conservative Party, etc., then they're likely to make the right decisions.
Well, you say silly people in the Conservative Party. I learned today that there is a common sense group of Conservative MPs joining the COVID Research Group, the European Research Group, the Northern Research Group. Danny, what is it with all these groups? And actually, do they achieve much?
The interesting thing about it is it's not common sense. In other words, in the literal sense, it's not a sense shared commonly. Most people don't think they're right.
That's a good grammatical issue to take with them.
And most people don't think they're right. The idea that kind of opening up early is some sort of common sense rebellion against silliness, right? When most of us can see, and that literally means most of us can see the scientific basis for what we're doing, and therefore believe it makes, you know, it's basically rational. That's what I object to in it. I think it's you know, in defiance even of what the Conservative voters that say someone like John Hayes thinks he speaks for, you know, that's leaving aside whether it's the right policy or not. It doesn't even, in its own political sense, follow from his premises.
David?
Look, I mean, you quite rightly have noted this kind of proliferation of interestingly named groups, particularly on the Conservative side, because they're the government, but they have a large majority. And so there isn't that, and there's a large number of people who aren't ministers who probably think that they ought to be, but need to find something to do. Yeah. And so they kind of form these kinds of groups. Now, I'm interested in the kind of nomenclature of it. So you get the European Research Group for people who don't like Europe, the Coronavirus Research Group for people who don't like coronavirus. And I'm presuming that this is the common sense ought to be the research group, because they don't much really like common sense, etc. They'd rather something else kind of took over. And this is the kind of sense, I think, of how these groups get set up. But I was wondering, because Danny will know, whether there had been even more exotically named groups. I mean, there are parliamentary backbench committees for just about everything, including, you know, solidarity with or trade links with or trade with countries that are so small you've never even heard of them, which means they kind of go there once every kind of 10 years or something like that on a freebie. And Danny, you're more familiar with these, and they probably have them in the House of Lords too, don't they?
It's proliferated, but underneath it, there is something that everyone has called for a long time, right, which is that the whip isn't as strong as it was 30 years ago. There just is more diversity of thought. People are able to take up the positions, you know, that they take up in the common sense group, although it is more about historical statues, of course, than it is about COVID. But but all these groups are taking positions that aren't necessarily guided by what the whips tell them the position should be. And that is a long-standing trend that I don't think we can expect to reverse. And most people probably wouldn't want to reverse it, even if, you know, it leads to some groups saying things that, say, David or I don't think are wise.
And do you think that has happened? Is that a direct result of having majority government? Like, would all of this slightly fall away if we were back in a coalition?
No, I think it's to do with the development of modern technologies, actually. I think that people have got the ability to express themselves independently much more, and there's also much more of much less of a regimented feel about politics, as indeed about public life. People are just a little less willing to go along and do what they're told. The Conservative Party, you know, people have said this, that it represents less of an army than it did before. And that has bad aspects in the sense that you can give a very loud voice to eccentric positions. But it has advantages too, because it does mean that the, you know, there's more diversity of thought.
Am I right in saying that you've both been vaccinated or had one jab? Is that right?
No. No. Not in my case.
David, have you?
I certainly have, yes.
Ah, well, because I was just wondering, I was interested in reading the paper today that the JCVI, the Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunisation, are meeting again today to decide on what they should advise happens next once we've got through these 1 to 9 priority groups. And the suggestion, it says, at least in the Times, is that they're going to agree that it should not be based on jobs, it should just continue to be age base. And I wonder, David, how much of an argument are we going to have over that? Because, of course, we've had the Labour policy over teachers, for example, already.
We are going to have an argument about it because different people will feel different things. I mean, I felt, a friend of mine got vaccinated 2 weeks before me, and I felt a really strange level of envy about it. A rather psychologically flawed feeling that I was being left behind. And if I was prepared to feel that in the 2 weeks that it took for me to get vaccinated, you can imagine what a lot of other people are going to be feeling.
Well, it's Danny.
As the question comes up of whether, exactly, but he is a very young person. I mean, you know, he's only just old enough to be your dad, Luke. I mean, that's how young he is. Whereas I'm considerably more venerable, and you should treat me with the respect accordingly. And I sometimes wonder whether you do. So there will be a huge argument about it. And there is the argument about teachers is interesting because Nadim Zahawi is saying, look, the thing is, insofar as teachers are in vulnerable groups, they will be being vaccinated now and will be vaccinated. The question about whether or not younger teachers who are not in risk groups need to have priority over people who are more likely to be in risk groups because of their proximity to children is a moot point. It was raised by Tony Blair. I've not yet seen the evidence that would suggest to me that that would be the priority that you would want. But people who are absolutely desperate, and I think we most of us are actually, to get schools back, tend to see this as a little bit of a magic bullet. And I just don't know whether that's true. And I mean, I don't know.
And Danny, I got it wrong. It was the Telegraph, and they say it's also suggests that prioritising occupations would be too complicated. But I wonder if the government is going to be data driven, and they say, well, we'll do what the JCVI tell us. Will that actually hold, or will there just be too much fury from people?
It'll hold. I think it probably will hold, because I think that that is Matt Hancock's view as well. And it should hold, in my view. The problem is that once you begin to start to try to work out what is a vital job and what is not a vital job, you really are lost, you know, because lots of people supply other people. If you had a rule that said everyone who had to go into work would be vaccinated before all those that who wouldn't, I think that would be extremely complicated line to police. And the kind of orderly queue that we've all formed could quite quickly break down. So I'm strongly for doing it by age. The truth with teachers is the evidence doesn't suggest they're more vulnerable than other parts of the population. And if it did, I think there'd be a different argument, because obviously we are asking them, as we do indeed other people like supermarket staff, for example, to do things that some people, i.e. newspaper columnists, don't always have to do. I think, of course, it has to be listened to respectfully, but I think the arguments against it are stronger than the arguments for it. It's not that there are no arguments for it, but ultimately you have to make a balance. But hopefully, the answer to this is just to get a shift on, do these quite rapidly. And so this argument, hopefully it'll be over before it started, because we'll have got sufficiently quickly through those people who are more seriously vulnerable and over 50.
Do you have that jealousy which David said that he felt?
Well, sort of, but it's not a feeling particularly to which I'm prone, so maybe less than I otherwise would.
Let's move on to something a little less contentious. Free speech in universities. The Education Secretary, Gavin Williamson, is going to outline measures to protect free speech in universities, including the idea of a free speech champion. What do you make of this, David?
For quite a number of years, I was chair of something called Index on Censorship, which is the leading advocacy group for free speech and freedom of expression, not just here and around the world. And I'm trying to work out, and I've left the board, and I'd be interested to know what they think about this. There is a problem. But whether the problem, how big the problem actually is, I mean, how kind of all-encompassing it is, and whether or not it requires this form of measure to deal with it is a completely different matter. And I've run it together a bit. You talked about the Common Sense group of Conservative MPs earlier. Mm. They came into prominence because of a letter to them from Oliver Dowden, the digital culture, media and sport secretary, who was meeting with people in English heritage, etc., apparently to kind of, you know, dust them down a bit about having woke history and airbrushing and so on, all this. And it struck me that this is very much kind of, it seems to be part of a move at the moment by the government to suggest, here are a series of things, important things that we're doing to kind of protect heritage and protect freedom of speech from this kind of, you know, the great kind of woke onslaught. When the woke onslaught, there is a bit of one, but it's not incredibly important. And I don't see any of these mechanisms as mechanisms which are likely to affect it. The final thing I'm going to say is I used to try and get to do fundraising for Index on Censorship. And I talked to somebody that Danny and I both know, who's a very big fundraiser, fundraises a lot for the Conservative Party. And what he said to me was, he said, you should, I'm not going to say, okay. And he said, I really support you, but you should understand that funding freedom of speech is seen as a much more left-wing cause than a right-wing cause. Well, how times change.
Danny, what do you think? Because David's just saying that it's not that massively a problem. Gavin Williamson saying today it's real and alarming.
Well, look, I think it sort of lies between those things. The problem with it, it's very difficult to get at. Let's take an example of somebody being invited to deliver a speech at a, you know, conference organised by the University Feminist Society, and then a group of people inside that society decide to uninvite her. Is that their right, or is it a breach of free speech? My view is that we have become, as a society, and it does worry me, sort of allergic to allowing anybody who's ever said something stupid from speaking. To give an example, right, I regard Ken Loach both as having ridiculous views about the organisation of society, and more specifically troubling ones about Jews. And nevertheless, I wouldn't suggest that we prevent him from giving a talk at a university, even expressing, you know, certainly not about his films, but even expressing views that I don't like. And because I don't think it fundamentally makes me unsafe. And I think that rhetoric is silly. But the idea that a champion of free speech appointed by Gavin Williamson is likely hugely to affect that, I find is a bit far-fetched.
But is the
and
point...
as for woke history, I think that's the whole point of history, that we would wake up to the things that have happened. It's just that we need to make sure we have a rounded view and not an ideological one, you know, or at least if we can have an ideological one, that it's correct ideology.
But isn't the idea that all of this is to protect people who need protecting? Like, of course, you're not going to feel threatened necessarily. You're a, well, surprisingly young, as we learned today, columnist. Whereas actually there might be some people in minorities who think actually, you know, we do need protection from this kind of thing.
It's important to assert that this is a very live issue for Jews, actually. And that's why I gave you the example of Ken Loach. So I do have, and it's not as though it doesn't, you know, for example, the spread of Holocaust denial on social media, you know, as the son of a Holocaust survivor, affected me very deeply personally. Yeah. So these are balances that you have to make the whole time, I think. And there's no clear line. There's no clean line. But my view is you ought to reduce the extent to which people feel that free speech makes them feel unsafe. You ought to encourage people to engage in argument and debate as far as possible. But there are always common sense boundaries, and it's trying to find those is very difficult. There is no clear line.
Yeah, no, but there is a test in law about whether or not free speech crosses the line, which is incitement to hatred and so on.
Yeah.
And we should allow the law essentially to define when that takes place. What I don't think you can have is a whole series of people saying, oh, I feel a bit kind of threatened by the fact that you have views that I don't have. Well, you might feel that way, but you probably aren't justified in feeling that. And it's no kind of terrible thing for me as a white man to say that I don't think that you should feel particularly threatened by it. And then you tell me, well, actually, I'm a kind of two or five kinds of categories of thing that should feel threatened by it. It becomes a problem in that way. The only thing is, I don't see that a free speech champion can do anything about it. I don't see that the various things that the government is suggesting in legal terms that it might conceivably do will actually work. I don't think they will actually happen, half of them, I have to say. And I think this is very much more about politics than it is about freedom of speech. I honestly do.
So it doesn't sound like either of you are going to pop in an application?
Free speech champion?
Yeah.
I think I'd be really good at it.
You'd be on the board of the Office for Students.
Yeah, I mean, £50,000 a year would it be for a day of work?
But let me give you an example of the contradictions involved in this. The government is also extremely concerned to prevent radicalisation in universities, right? So clearly it believes there is some kind of speech that they don't want, as well as speech. So these things are just difficult lines, right? Is it compulsory for organisations in universities to invite people they don't like, for instance, right? So there are lots of different lines that somebody will have to subtly navigate. Yeah. On the other hand, right, I do basically agree that protecting diversity of thought in universities and defending against the idea that freedom of speech makes people unsafe, that is a very important thing to repel.
A quick final thought on this, because I know you want to move on. Yeah, very quickly. The argument about this has got to be a political argument with people about the values of freedom of speech, not a bureaucratic one about what the champion says or what the law says.
You're listening to the Red Box Politics Podcast. That was Danny Finkelstein and David Aronovich. Up next, the UK Parliament is the gayest it's ever been.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, it's time to take you to one of Parliament's success stories. After the 2019 general election, the UK took the title of the world's gayest parliament with 45 out gay MPs. Sadly, though, it was stripped of this title after New Zealand's election in autumn last year. But still, an incredible step forward for a country where homosexuality was illegal for literally hundreds of years. We wanted to look at how we got here, from the laws which kept people oppressed to the pioneers who worked to make things better. In just a moment, we'll hear from three current and former MPs, Labour, Conservative and SNP, about their experiences as out MPs. But first, I spoke to Penny McMahon from the Parliamentary Archives. I started by asking her to explain the background of laws prohibiting homosexuality in the UK and how that affected politics.
Same-sex relationships between men has been illegal in the UK since 1533, so under the reign of Henry VIII. That legislation is still in place until the 1800s, when it changes slightly, but you could still get kind of life imprisonment. There's kind of a change then in terms of the Criminal Law Amendment Act is passed in 1885, And before that time, it's really kind of focused on kind of the act of sodomy, but isn't really kind of talking about kind of same-sex love and desire. But what the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1885 does is that it puts in an amendment that any acts of gross indecency between two men is now illegal. And this is kind of what Oscar Wilde was prosecuted under. And it meant that people could go to jail for kind of 2 years. So it kind of has this massive effect, really, on sort of how openly gay men in particular could live their lives. So gay women aren't mentioned at this time. They're not really covered in the legislation. So which is why it's kind of amazing that the first woman that kind of is openly, the first MP that is openly gay is an MP, so Maureen Culhane. So what's really interesting about her was she was elected in 1974, and at the time she was married to a man, lived in Surrey, had kind of three kids, and they all lived together. And she fell in love with a woman, her partner, called Babs. So by 1976, she lived in London with her partner, and they were kind of they were openly a couple, although not kind of publicly open. And she was kind of outed by a newspaper, a reporter, who basically did a big expose kind of on her life. So she was never actually elected as a gay woman. She was kind of elected as a married heterosexual woman who was kind of outed, even though she did live her life kind of openly, but not publicly openly, if that makes sense.
Yeah. When did we start to see more people, and I guess people who were elected, and when it was known that they were openly gay, men or women?
Yeah, absolutely. So we had Chris Smith in 1984, who came out as gay, and during a rally where he was protesting a possible ban on gay employees in a town in Rugby. And it's really kind of extraordinary when I read about this, because there's quite a lot of hostility, particularly towards gay men during the early 80s, that it's kind of, so it's really like amplified by the AIDS epidemic and the fear and the unknown kind of around that. The first kind of act that was really kind of a change in the tide, really, in terms of LGBT plus relationships, was the Sexual Offences Act in 1967. And that was kind of based on the recommendations of the Wolfenden Report. These recommendations are made in kind of 1957, but it's not until 1967 that we see the legislation being adopted. And actually there's kind of like a partnership between Leo Wabsey, who's an MP, a Welsh MP that sort of is very dapper in his dress, always followed with a bow tie, and a Lord Arran. And between the two of them, they pushed kind of a bill to decriminalise same-sex relationships between men every year, until kind of 1966, when it was kind of eventually it was accepted.
That's Penny McMahon from the Parliamentary Archives. So what has life been like for out gay MPs? First, let's hear from Labour MP Chris Brines. I asked him to first take me back almost 20 years to when he first entered Parliament.
I'm not sure that when I arrived, I was particularly conscious of being a gay man, except that there were, so far as I can remember, no out gay Tories at all then. Mm. Alan Duncan came out a little bit later, Nigel Evans a long time later, and in fact I remember trying to persuade him to come out, and he said that he couldn't do so until after another general election for some reason. And in the intervening years, I've had a few kind of difficult moments. There was a moment when one Tory MP said he wouldn't give way to me in a debate on smacking because I was a notorious homosexual who would never have children of his own.
What?
Yeah. They said that out loud
in the chamber.
Out loud in the chamber, yes. Well, David Cameron quite frequently referred to my sexuality in debates.
In what way?
Not in a laudatory way, let's put it that way. He wasn't... He was trying to tease, and George Osborne had a go at me, calling me a pantomime dame. It's not. I mean, you know, most of these things are water off a duck's back, and I don't care. Mm. But Parliament hasn't changed as much as some might hope it has.
And what about now? Is there still that kind of language or attitude in the chamber, not in the chamber?
I think nowadays, well, it's difficult to know who the gay MPs are. There are so many that, and that's great. It's, you know, I never wanted to be a gay MP. I wanted to be the Labour MP for the Rhondda. Hmm. I mean, in my constituency, I remember when I was selected as a candidate, I think even the Independence headline was how pink was my valley, and the Times, the Guardian, the Telegraph all predicted that I'd lose the seat because of my sexuality. I got elected with a majority of more than 10,000, and I've very, very rarely faced open homophobia. I mean, I'm president of lots of rugby clubs, and everybody loves taking or having a pop at me kind of thing, but I give as good as I get and everybody loves it. It's fine. Rugby is fortunately a very generous sport when it comes to homosexuality. I can't put it in a better way than that.
Yeah. And I'll ask you about the sort of more recent environment in a moment, but in your time, would you say the House of Commons overall in your career has been homophobic? As you mentioned sort of comments you'd had in debates and things like that, but as a place of work, as an institution, has it been, is it still maybe homophobic?
Well, one person who is very senior in the House still today, I remember telling me that I was a disgrace and shouldn't be an MP because I was gay.
Are they still an MP?
I remember a doorkeeper telling me that he wouldn't open a door for me because I was gay. Now, I mean, all of these things have, for the most part, changed. But they haven't entirely, I think.
It sounds like you're saying, yes, it is a homophobic place to work.
I don't think it is compared to lots of other places, but I have met some homophobia, is what I'm saying. I think it is limited now to a small number of people, but those people, I think, for them in the main, know how to hide it. Mm. But I'm afraid I have a long memory.
Yeah.
And a diary.
And a diary. Good grief.
Yes. I remember one MP telling me that he had been taking bets with journalists about when I would commit suicide when I got into trouble with the Mail on Sunday back in 2003.
I'm slightly gobsmacking, but a member of parliament in your own party. I mean, not that makes a difference, but
a member of parliament.
Member of parliament. What about the upsides? The reason we're doing this is because, of course, the UK Parliament is the gayest parliament. When can you first remember that actually out members of parliament were making changes which were for the benefit of LGBT people? When did you start to feel the impact and the benefit of there being gay people on the benches?
I remember there was a very complicated row when Labour was legislating first of all for civil partnerships. There was a very complicated row about pensions, on which I'm not a great expert, but the fact that Angela Eagle and I could combine and could knock on Gordon Brown's door and could say openly, look, you've got to address this issue because it's manifestly unfair that people entering civil partnerships now will not enjoy the same pension freedoms that their equivalents in heterosexual marriages will enjoy. I mean, that made a dramatic difference. Yes, it did. And the fact that we could be open about it. Likewise, I remember going to see Tony Blair to talk about the we were changing the law so that companies wouldn't be able to discriminate in the provision of goods and services when on grounds of sexuality. And there was a row about that because some of the adoption agencies, the Catholic adoption agencies, although they already put children with individual homosexual men or women, were refusing to put them with couples. And we thought that this was bizarre. And we went to see Tony Blair about it. And I seem to recall we took Greg Pope, who was a Labour MP, along because we thought that maybe being called Pope somehow or other, this might help in the discussion. But actually, Tony was absolutely clear and open and robust. But it was great that, you know, there was a group of seven or eight gay Labour MPs who were able to have a conversation with them. Yeah. I remember going to see the Archbishop of Canterbury, both Rowan Williams and then Justin Welby, as a group of gay MPs to talk about issues in the Church of England and the ordination of women and so on. But there's one thing I'd say, which is that I think there were lots of MPs in the past, before Chris Smith even, and before Maureen Colquhoun, who probably thought they were out, in that, you know, they never really sort of hid it, and everybody sort of knew.
You mean in a sort of Kenneth Williams kind of way?
Well, you know, yeah, or more... there weren't quite as camp as that, but Charles Irving used to, who's the MP for Cheltenham for many years, Conservative MP, he used to send a bunch of roses to Mrs. Thatcher every single day. I think he got into trouble cottaging at one point. And he also rescued, incidentally, a Labour MP who got into terrible trouble I think dressed in a Nazi outfit in a club in Berlin, and Charles Irving paid the Labour MPs legal expenses, as I understand it. But there were quite a few in the 60s, 70s and 80s who were sort of semi out, is the best way of putting it. But they never had, because they couldn't be properly out, they couldn't make the case for reform in so many different areas. And it was only when, you know, Jack Straw and Tony Blair became the team driving forward this policy in government in 1997, and you had a whole, you know, swathe of gay and lesbian MPs, that you were really able to make the difference.
That's Labour MP Chris Bryant. In a moment, we'll hear from the former Conservative MP, Justin Greening, about what it was like coming out whilst in the Cabinet. And we'll also hear from the SNP's Hannah Bardell, who was elected as an MP in 2015.
This is Times Radio.
And it is LGBT History Month, so we are reflecting on the UK Parliament, officially the gayest it's ever been. So we're speaking to current and former MPs about their experiences as LGBT politicians. We just heard from Chris Bryant, the Labour MP, even saying at one point that a doorkeeper in the Commons wouldn't open a door for him, saying it was because he was gay. I've also been hearing this morning from Justin Greening, of course, the former Conservative Education Secretary. And I asked her what it means to have better representation in Parliament for LGBT people.
What it's meant is that the UK has been able to move ahead on things like same-sex marriage, possibly faster maybe than other countries. And certainly from my very personal perspective, having also spent time as International Development Secretary, I think whenever we were talking about the importance of LGBT rights internationally, it meant that we were able to do so from a genuine position of credibility. And I think that really helped. So I think it's not only been important for change within the UK, of course, there's a long way to go and all of that. But I think it has helped us internationally as well.
We just heard from Chris Bryant, the Labour MP, and I was quite shocked at the number of instances he could reel off where he'd faced homophobia in the chamber, from members of House of Commons staff. It was quite incredible. I wonder if you've ever experienced anything like that.
I haven't, but I think it's probably thanks to people like Chris who've been you know, known for being part of the LGBT community for a lot longer than I have. I think it's thanks to the progress that they insisted was made that actually by the time I came out and did my tweet about being in a same-sex relationship, I think Parliament was in a much, much better place. But actually, it's been a long journey, and it's been people like Chris who've fought, actually, to help make it a better environment. But my experience in 2016 was, I mean, for MPs, I felt it was massively positive, but I also feel we were at a stage where we'd done a lot of things as a Parliament. And whilst I'd been an MP, to help shift things forward, it's almost like we'd had that debate. I think same-sex marriage, which it's easy to forget, if you like, that one of the things that David Cameron did as Prime Minister, that he didn't arguably need to do, was to bring in same-sex marriage. And I almost felt like, for our Parliament, that was an important debate about equality. But it sort of moved people on again. Mm. Do you see what I mean? I felt like it was a time where you could have, where we ended up revisiting something fresh, and I think it helped move things on. And so I think now we're in a much better position than we've been in the past. But yeah, I think it's obviously unacceptable that people like Chris have ever had those sorts of experiences.
But even from, you mentioned there, David Cameron, that was one example that he used, David Cameron in the Commons Chamber, referring to him as a pantomime dame, which Chris Bryant saw as a homophobic slur. I mean, even that, as recent as this, it's quite shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think what it shows is it's almost this risk of not just conscious bias, but also unconscious bias, and this point I made earlier, which is actually there's a lot more to be done on the issue of LGBT rights. And whilst I was Minister for Women and Equality, which was a role I held whilst I was also Secretary for Education, we did this LGBT survey of the community to get a sense of these wider issues that the community faces. And there was an incredible response to it. We had something like 110,000 different people come back on the survey. But what it showed was that there are still issues around homophobia, you know, physical violence. And you know, we've seen that recently as well with attacks on people. But also just the health system, you know, provision on mental health in particular. And just a real sense that there's a wider agenda out there that needs to be understood and worked on if you're going to really make this a version of a country where it genuinely doesn't matter, you know, whether you're straight or gay or however you want to put that. There's a long way to go.
Justine Greening, former Conservative MP and Minister. It's 25 minutes past 11. Let's go live to Hannah Bardell, SNP MP, elected in 2015. Good morning.
Good morning, Luke. Pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure to have you on. And we're talking to you because the SNP has the honour of being the gayest party by proportion.
Yes.
What do you
Nine
make of
us.
That?
Yeah, it's hugely positive, and I'm very proud to be one of the nine in our group at Westminster and in the Scottish Parliament as well. We have many gay MSPs across the political spectrum. You know, at one time we had three of the leaders in the Scottish Parliament who were gay. It's very proud, but I think it's important that we reflect on, as both Chris and Justine have, how far we've come, but also how far we've still got to go and the challenges that folk in the LGBT community still have to face, both here in the UK and abroad. You know, a lot of those countries, that 72 nations across the world, that there's still it's still illegal to be gay, and I think 11 of those where it's punishable by death, and lots of those are former Commonwealth nations. So there's an important role for us to play internationally as well as at home.
Well, at home, I wonder what you think that the practical, actual policy decisions should and could be taken now to bring about more equality.
I think there are, across so many policy areas, I mean, you know, the news today about veterans, I think is a really important step forward. And I remember the battle that John Nicholson, my colleague and friend, had when we brought forward gay pardons. You know, and there was a real back and forth about that, and that was really disappointing. And it's positive to see that the UK government seems to have moved on and is now looking at other areas. So yes, things like, you know, people who have historically been persecuted and discriminated against, I think that's, it's a huge step forward, because reading some of the experiences of veterans who were either pushed out of their roles or discharged and shamed is horrific. But there's also areas in health, particularly in terms of health inequality. For we had a debate just before COVID, actually, just before COVID broke, and we all had to start working from home. And we spoke a lot about the health inequalities. There's still, you know, disproportionately high levels of suicide and self-harm, particularly amongst LGBT young people, particularly amongst the trans community, who've had, you know, a really tough time of late. And we have lesbian, gay, bisexual members in the House of Commons and in the Scottish Parliament and other parliaments across the UK. We don't have any trans members. Mm. So that's something, you know, seeing Petra de Sutter, for example, become the deputy Prime Minister in Belgium, and Sarah McBride become the most senior trans elected representative in the US, a Delawarean state senator, was, I think, a really big moment.
And why do you think that hasn't happened yet in either the Scottish Parliament or in the House of Commons?
I think for the same reasons that we, you know, when I got elected in 2015, there were still more men in that sitting than had ever been women elected. Mm-hmm. You know, we have come a long way, but we having people in positions of power who've got different perspectives and who are from minority communities is still a big challenge. And it's about the structural barriers of politics. And it's one of the reasons I stood for election, because I looked at the lineup of what was there at Westminster, and I thought, well, there's not very many young, you know, working class from a single parent gay MPs. Now, I didn't come out until after I was elected, you know, so hearing Chris's experience is quite galling, actually. Although in recent times, you know, many folk will know about the, you know, really grim experience I had with Lord McGuinness. There are still legislators in some parts of our parliament, in the House of Lords particularly, who are, you know, very anti-LGBT and homophobic. And, you know, but I got a huge amount of support from members in both houses when I came out and over the Lord McGuinness issue. But I think it's, you know, we still have a distance to travel. And I think the narrative at the moment that, you know, there's a lot of misinformation and dark actors on the internet, particularly. And some of the debates, the really toxic debates around trans issues, have, you know, been funded, I think. And there's certainly evidence that shows that from the US and places. And that's infiltrating largely within the sort of Twitter bubble and Twitter sphere, but it's doing a lot of damage, and there's not been a decent space to have a decent discussion.
Well, there's also not been that decent discussion within the SNP, has there? The sort of trans rights is quite a divisive issue within the party at the moment, and I wonder what damage you think that is doing for young trans people generally, but also trans people who might want to one day be in the Scottish Parliament. It might put them off, do you think?
You make some very fair points, and I think it's something that, you know, all political parties have had challenges with. But yes, absolutely, within the SNP we've had challenges, and it's about, I think, creating space to have a decent discussion. And I think all the evidence shows that, you know, we're spending so much more of our lives online at the moment, and online is where the discussion has got really toxic, and people have questions and they need to be answered, but also we need to be able to protect people. And you're absolutely right. When the discussion becomes so toxic, people are pushed out, you know, and they don't want to take part. Now, whether that's in discussion, whether that's in participation politically, and that's really important that we are trying, you know, to address some of that. But in terms of who we have in Parliament, you know, and the fact that we have so many LGBT MPs at Westminster, you know, it's incredibly important. It's incredibly important, I think, for the fact that, you know, it was such a big deal for people like Chris Bryant, you know, when they came out. You know, when I came out, it was about a year after I got elected, or about 8 months, and I made a conscious decision not to be the first thing I said about myself, because I was just coming to terms with it, really, as I was getting elected. And it was actually Chris who organised a photograph for all the LGBT MPs and peers, and I took part in that, and that felt like a natural thing, but it was still a thing. Mm. And I questioned whether I needed to say anything. I thought, you know, are we not at the stage where really it doesn't matter? I thought, no, I hold a position of power and influence. And I came out with the cover and privilege of being an elected representative. You could argue also the exposure of that, but, you know, there's lots of people in workplaces and different walks of life around the UK that still struggle to come out. They struggle to come out to their families. They struggle to come out to their friends because of, you know, structural or cultural issues. And that's something that we, you know, Justine talks about her role as, you know, International Development Secretary and going abroad, and the fact that we've got such a good record. We do in many respects in the UK, but there are still issues that need addressed.
Yeah.
And we can only advocate on the global stage on LGBT rights if we are doing our very best for everybody in that community, you know, and that, I think that's really important. So
yeah.
Working across parliaments, working across governments, and us using our voices, and also I think remembering our history and celebrating our history, seeing the Russell T Davies programme, you know, It's a Sin. I recommended it to lots of friends who are, you know, are heterosexual, who are not necessarily aware of some of these issues. And one of my friends who's a straight guy, he watched it and he was so taken aback. He was like, I can't believe that this happened in my lifetime. I didn't know anything about it. For a lot of people, this, you know, the treatment of people with HIV, of the gay community in the 80s, it passed them by. You know, they weren't in the 90s, you know, and it's quite unbelievable. So I think that's the advent of new kinds of media, Netflix, yeah. Amazon, the space to create new programmes, and us spending so much more of our lives online has its advantages as well.
That's all we've got time for on the Red Box Politics podcast. Remember, you can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, including, by the way, the Times Radio app. And you can read the Red Box email every morning. You just have to subscribe to the Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk/subscribe.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.